Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello, and welcome to The Hobcast, the weekly podcast where Hoback Books talks about what it's like to be a publisher in this very strange pandemic world. My name is Rebecca Collins, and my co-host is...
Adrian Hobart. And the reason I'm not leading this program is I have the most monumental tooth pain, and it's been going on for several days, and I'm really not up to this. So, Rebecca is taking the lead. Away you go.
I should mention, before we start chatting, is we are publishers of...
Crime.
Thrillers.
Suspense.
Mystery. See, that wasn't too bad this week, was it? They said, whoops, cool. Throw everything on the floor.
It's only your phone, don't worry about it.
Oh, that phone, it's used to being chucked around.
It is. So welcome to The Hobcast. Oh, I found my voice now. Look, it doesn't affect my voice. It just affects my ability to think and interact and believe in life because it comes in waves, this pain. And I try to get emergency dental treatment. Yeah, try doing that during a pandemic at an Easter weekend. Ain't going to happen.
There's double whammy there.
Yeah. So I don't know really what to say. I've never known anything like it. And I haven't slept very well for days now. And it really has affected things. So my news is fairly limited, but you've got plenty.
Yes. So and we do this every week. We keep our eyes out for things to tell you about, this, things that have happened in the news. And the first thing that I noticed was the beginning of the week, and it was so Nielsen, who I don't really know how you describe Nielsen, what they do.
Well, Nielsen are the, in this country at least, they are the organisation who register ISBNs. That's one thing. They're also a bit like, I guess you would call them... Well, Nielsen BookScan is the official way of recording sales of books, is it not?
Yes, that's right.
So a bit like if you're in the States, the Billboard chart records how records are doing over there. And over here, it used to be the Gallup chart. I'm not sure what it is now.
It did, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So essentially, yeah, they form two major functions that affect us. Our chart position, negligible. And the other thing is, of course, ISBNs, which we bought a whole load of them off of Nielsen and attribute to our books.
And also, so for every book that we published, whether it's an ebook or a physical book, we have to register it with Nielsen. And it's just sort of the basic metadata, but it means that, you know, it's official when we do that. So one of the things that Nielsen do, as you rightly said, is they keep a chart of all the sales. So they therefore have an interesting bank of statistics on, and they have analysts who look at the sort of fluctuations of
trends,
sales. Trends. And yeah. And so they've just published their 2020 trends, and they have reported, I think it's a 16% increase in ebook sales in 2020 compared to previous years, which is kind of as predicted because of the pandemic. You know, people have been at home, they haven't been able to go to bookshops to buy physical books, so they might have downloaded more ebooks to read at home. And also, sort of from an academic perspective, academic publishing. So a lot of the sort of the university presses, especially, and academic publishers have put more investment into subscription and ebooks for people who had to learn at home. So it's not really that surprising.
We discussed this before I was unable to think about anything other than pain. I suggested, some of those sales are down to backlist non-fiction titles being put onto ebooks, I'm sure, to cover the educational gaps that have appeared in universities, higher education, primary schools, you name it, secondary schools across the world. The fact is that home education was the big selling point, and people were desperately looking for workbooks and things to keep their, you know, to teach their kids with. So I think that has been a large part of it, because I don't detect massive surge in fiction sales, really.
No, I mean,
I think some of the physical copies have gone onto ebooks.
Yeah, so there must be a portion of that that is accounted for that. But I think you're right. I think if we were able to sort of dig deeper into this percentage, it'd be interesting to see how much is sort of higher level academic, you know, school level learning as well. You know, sort of break it down a bit, and then because sometimes when you have a statistic like that and you look at it at face value, it doesn't really tell you that much. You know, you do need to know sort of the subtleties behind it.
There's statistics, damn lies and statistics. You know, that, or whatever the phrase is, but you know what I mean. You can interpret any which way, but I always urge caution when people jump onto, particularly when it comes to audiobooks, another 16% double-digit growth for the eighth year in a row. But if it's 8%, you know, it's 16% of nothing. It's still nothing. You know, see what I mean? It's, you know, it could be quite a small market. It can grow by double figures and not really make any difference. I digress. We ought to mention, of course, that we have an interview a little later, which we didn't mention earlier, which is part two of our interview with Lewis Hastings from New Zealand, the author of the Seventh Wave trilogy, and of course, The Angel of Whitehall, and soon The Chemist. So we delve into the second part of that interview a little later with Lewis Hastings. So looking forward to that. More news, though.
The other thing that caught me is almost the opposite sort of type of news. It's a quaint story, and it's about a bookshop in Pembrokeshire. This bookshop has been in the same location for 54 years, and because of the pandemic, had to move to a bigger location. I think it was to do with rent issues rather than the actual pandemic. But it was the smallest bookshop in Britain. So in a way, I think that's a little bit sad that they had to move and obviously lost their status as
their
USP.
That is bittersweet, isn't it? So Pembrokeshire in Wales, for those who aren't familiar with British geography, many of you are, I know, but just to point that out. That is an odd one. The one story that's caught my eye this week, apart from part two of Audible Gate, which is the podcast I recommended a couple of weeks ago, looking at the level of, how do we put this, scandal surrounding Audible and audiobooks and how narrators and authors are being paid, and the way that Amazon and Audible themselves are keeping information from us. Actually, it's interesting because they released a new desktop monitoring system so that you can see your sales in greater detail, but actually it revealed absolutely nothing apart from the fact that, for instance, in the last month, three of the audiobook titles that someone had bought from that I narrated were handed back, and therefore I didn't get paid for. So there is a little bit more transparency, but that still doesn't mean realistically that that's fair. That's all I'm saying, but we'll talk about that again. The other story that I saw before I digressed, and I'm really all over the place, HarperCollins pulling out of the London Book Fair, which is a big, big, significant move, but they're basically not convinced it's going ahead, because the organisers of the London Book Fair have said they would make a decision in March, and we're now in April. Oh. And they're saying mid-April now for a decision. And I guess that is a lot to do with this talk of, in this country at least, COVID jab passports, or whatever they're calling them.
The system, isn't it, that if you've had your vaccines, I guess both of the vaccines, then you can apply for this passport and you can go and hug people at your...
I'm not sure they're saying go and hug people, but they're certainly... I think a lot of events in the summer are going to be dependent on whether you've had both jabs in the United Kingdom, and that will be festivals and sporting events and all sorts of things like that. So we will get more details as this podcast goes out, but... it is, you know, again, if someone as big as HarperCollins pulls out of the London Book Fair, it does question whether the whole thing's going to be viable this year. Having said that, for us, you know, we were discussing with our authors this week the importance of going there and trying to find some third-party representation for things that you and I simply haven't got the contacts to do, which is sell international rights and to leverage our way into bookshops. which, you know, is much, much harder than it should be, really.
I suppose the worrying thing is, because this happened last year with the London Book Fair, that as soon as somebody gets nervous and pulls out, the others start dithering, don't they? And it could be in danger of being cancelled completely just because of those nerves.
Yeah, it'll be a domino effect. But it'd be interesting to see whether people hold their nerves and wait for that final decision. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It is one of the highlights of, you know, being a publisher and going to your big trade fair in the capital city is a fun thing to do. It's exhausting, but you learn a lot. And
you get to meet lots of people that you don't meet normally during the year because you're all scattered around the country.
But just imagine trying to do socially distanced queuing for the coffee.
Or the orange juice.
Yeah, or the orange juice, yeah.
As we did 2 years ago.
Oh, boy, yeah. Orange juice gate. Well, that was quite a scrum, wasn't it? I mean, that was one of those where there was nearly a fist fight between a bunch of Lucindas and Teresas and all the other people who work in publishing over who's orange juice. I don't know, Philippas and Tarquins and all that, and us. There was a lot of fighting going on.
Well, I think
it was almost a fist fight over the orange juice stand.
Well, the difficulty was that it was towards the end of the day, and and I were both, we needed the sugar, and we were very thirsty and very hot. And it was just the longest time to wait for somebody to squeeze an orange into a cup that I've ever encountered. And I was ready to kill. And then they were at the stand, they'd say, two orange juices, and my hand was raising to say, yep, they must be mine, when somebody would get there first.
Yeah.
It was very frustrating.
Yeah, Blinking Bloomsbury got in, stepped in. No, anyway, these are very much first world problems.
At the time, it was huge,
yeah. So we've got some Hoback news. We should have led with that, really, shouldn't we?
Possibly, but, you know. They're still listening, so.
All right. Well, we've had quite a few exciting developments this week in our little world.
We've had a really busy week, actually.
Yeah. And one of the big announcements is we have a new author signed to Hoback. Tell us more, Rebecca.
We do. So this author he's called Harry Fisher. He's actually written two books, but he submitted his second book to us called 666 as the first in a potential series. And he submitted it a while ago, and we were extremely busy at the time. So it was lurking in the submissions pile.
You were busy. I was lazy.
I didn't want to say that out loud.
No, fair enough. Well, I'm saying it. I'm being honest here.
And so I think it was about a month ago. It was a Monday. And I said to you, I said, right, today is submissions day. We're going to sit down in the sitting room. We can't go to a cafe, but we can have coffee, sit in the living room, and sit on the sofa and read submissions, which is what we did. And both of us independently had a look at Harry's submission, and we looked at each other and went, oh my, we got to see the whole manuscript.
Yeah, we did. It was brilliant. It's a brilliant book. And we think we found someone of enormous talent. I mean, alongside our other very, very talented authors, but this one was, well, what how did we, in try and describe it to people? It's Martin Amis meets Ian Rankin.
Yeah, I mean, that's the best way I could think of describing it. So, I've read both.
Very, very funny, dark, brilliant plotting, fabulous characters, set in Leith. So there's a bit of a Rankin element to it. Just great. Just a great modern fiction tale, albeit crime. And, you know, a moralistic tale in many ways, but you know, also satirizing modern life. It covers so many areas.
I think for me, what the biggest talent that Harry has that I don't see in many writers is timing. It's almost like he's got this sense of timing of how many words to put to express a certain character or a certain scene, and he knows when to stop and when to move on. It was just tight, as you said, it was tight.
Yes, it's very well judged. So we're really looking forward to bringing you 666. We may change the title, but at the moment it's 666, and that will be an autumn release. Do we have other news?
We do. So we also spoke to another potential author. We can't tell you who this is yet because it's not official, but we're very, very hopeful that we got somebody else who's coming to join our team, who's written the first book again in a potentially a series.
An experienced author, though, from a different genre.
Yeah. She's written. Oh, I've just revealed the gender.
Well, this is the jigsaw effect, as we used to say it in the newsroom. You know, when you're dealing with a crime story, you have to avoid the jigsaw effect, which means that, you know, on three different bulletins, you might reveal you know, details about the victim or the perpetrator, alleged perpetrator, or indeed the location, you know, that sort of thing. And then people can piece together who the victim is.
Damn it. I didn't know about that. Okay.
Anyway, well, look, that...
Well, that's 50% of the population rolled out.
So we've got another potential author.
Yes. So we spoke to her as well. But we also spoke to another lady who is also an author, incidentally, but not with Hoback, who, as well as a very successful crime writer with a different publisher, is also an actress and narrator. And she is going to be the narrator of Sleeping Dogs by Wendy Turbin.
Yeah, that was really exciting. You know, I was a bit awestruck, really, because the person involved, and we will reveal later who it is. In fact, if you listen to the first chapter, if you go to Wendy's website at wendyturbin.com, you'll find out who it is. Oh, I'll tell you, it's Judy Dakin, who has been spectacularly successful with her first two novels for another publisher. I mean, really major best-selling author and wonderful to meet her this week. So I was a bit sort of starstruck, and her husband Rex, who's going to do the technical stuff. So lovely to meet them. So it's been a really, really busy week. And we have, as many people will be waiting on this podcast, something we will announce after we've spoken to Lewis Hastings, which is the winner of our Easter competition, tied in with Sleeping Dogs and Wendy Turbin and a whole host of cream eggs, the ones that have managed to escape my grasp. And it has been pointed out to me that my dental pain and dental abscess, I assume it is, must be in relation or punishment for my stealing of cream eggs in the last few weeks.
I didn't want to say that, because that would just, I think that would make you feel even more miserable, but potentially yes.
Okay, I think it's high time we moved away from the news and spoke to Lewis Hastings, our interview this week. And yes, we'll reveal the winner of the cream egg competition a little bit later after that. But Lewis works day to day in policing and works in New Zealand, and has had a 30-odd year career in that area. But a few years ago, picked up the pen, or the laptop as it nowadays is, and wrote his first book. And now he's on his fifth, The Chemist, which is a continuation of the saga involving Jack Cade, fantastic former British cop who is now involved in dealing with some of the biggest scandals and conspiracies in the Seventh Wave trilogy, The Angel of Whitehall, and soon The Chemist. But so we were talking to him about what it's like being an author and the issue of being, well, how do we put it? What sort of character is an author? Is it someone who wants to take the limelight or hide in the shadows?
That's a very good question.
One for Lewis Hastings.
You can be an extrovert, but when it comes to writing, you're exposing yourself so dramatically. And it's interesting, isn't it, when readers who know you say, I was reading your book the other day and I could hear you talking. They know it's you because they can, quote, hear you talking. And I wasn't aware of that. And I thought, do I stop that? And they said, no, not at all. Because you talk well, you're articulate, you're measured, you're intelligent. At that point, I knew they were lying. But the reality is, yeah, you do. You expose yourself to the whim of anybody that wants to basically just destroy your character. But for me, one really great piece of feedback lifts you up, gives you the most amazing feeling, and you just think, yeah, I'm doing this. You know, most authors these days don't expect to be multimillionaires, do they? So we must do it for another reason. We must do it to entertain, I think. That's the broad basic of being an author in the modern world. You want to be an entertainer, but you don't want to be on stage.
And also, like you were talking about earlier, getting the story out of you. The story's in your system, and it's your release, your obsession. You want to get it out, and you can't help it. You can't stop it.
Yeah, I mean, 3 o'clock this morning, I was awake thinking, well, that can't work. The new book, the new, not the new book, the new book. I've already got some research going on in Southeast Asia for that, which is fantastic already. And I just thought, no, that can't, X can't be Y if Z's involved. you know, 3 o'clock this morning. And you just think, go away and leave me alone. I blame you entirely. You gave me the opportunity to have a go at this, and I'm loving it. And I have to say, when the novel started turning up here at Hastings Towers, when I lifted the first copy of The Angel out of that brown paper bag, it was like the scene, you know, when Mufasa stands on the rock and he holds Simba up to the audience, and you get that iconic piece of music at the beginning. That's how it felt. I looked at it and thought, wow, cleared a load of books off the bookshelf, and I've just stacked them up, as you've seen on one of the pictures. And I'm looking at them now, and the pride of seeing that. It's been worth all the arguments over the word brunette with you, Rebecca.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Well, I actually ran a poll at work, and I said, you know, we're supposed to be the experts in describing people. Come up with another word. So if the listener's not sure, we had a joust for some time over the word brunette, because you felt that it was an old-fashioned word. And it wasn't until it was pointed out, and I'm paranoid now, that you do use, as a writer, you use words a lot that you don't realise you repeat them over and over and over again. A lot of my sentences start with, oh, O-H. Oh, so you think you're the man, do you? Oh, so you think you're going to steal the car and run that way? And there am I, throwing in brunettes left, right and centre. And it wasn't until you pointed it out with your wicked editorial tongue that I realised. And I have to say, the editing, I know we're jumping all over the place here, but the editing was for me far more intimidating and scary than anything I've done in 31 years of international policing.
Now that's saying something.
Yeah, no, but it, in fairness, it's the same for us here, because, you know, we were, let's put people in put this in context. So you came to us with 4 books, 3 that had been published and 1 that was ready to go, and we asked you, we went through them and said, look, we think by some judicious editing we can strengthen these. And particularly, it was, you know, there were certain sensitive areas where we felt that needed a sort of more modern approach, which, you know, has changed. I mean, in terms of people's tastes, I think have changed dramatically in the last couple of years, and so we were reacting to that. And it was very, very difficult for us. You know, I remember writing the email saying, "Look, we've got to get this, address this," and it was really difficult. Thinking this is quite tough, personal. I didn't know how you were going to take it. And the impact it was having, and I was very nervous about that.
Well, you should be. It deeply upset me, Adrian, for days. Honestly, I mean, it didn't. And you know what? This is why we have such a damn good relationship. I did say to somebody recently, they're more like friends than my publishers, and I thought, I don't know if that's a good thing or not. But that's how I feel. I feel that you're my friends and my publisher, and that's probably a rarity in the industry we're involved in. I suspect if I was with one of the big 5 or 6 or whatever they are these days, I'd be just another writer. But I know you give a damn and you care about what I write. And for you to broach that subject, yes, it was courageous. But I'm so glad you did, because I'm not exactly a dinosaur. I'm a long way off extinction. But I've grown up in that sort of that 70s, 80s period where things were very different only back then. You know, I heard that Kylie Minogue has had a top 10 album in the last 5 decades the other day, and it aged me dramatically, because I can remember all of them.
Yeah.
But going back in that time, you're right. I mean, should I dare mention good old Lucy? Because that was a character in my books that real. Like almost all of the characters, you know, they're all based on real people, with the exception of one person. And when I wrote about Lucy, was a character I came across on my stint on Vice Squad. And I remember thinking, one day you'll be in a book, and one day I hope to write it. And people love that character.
Yeah.
But we were sensitive how we put it down, I guess, in words, you know, that were not demeaning, but recognised that, and this is basically, if you like, transgender, which is obviously sensitive, but I know that what I wrote was good enough to get across the finish line and to actually give that character some real colour and some real life. And I know the real Lucy would have been delighted with it.
Yeah, no, it was, as you say, transgender character, beautifully realised, incredibly impactful in the books that they featured in, and really made us, you know, I mean, you know, when Lucy meets her fate, it is one of the most gut-wrenching, emotional things that certainly we've published, but I've ever read, I think. It really hurts.
Thank you. That's, yeah, that's, that means an awful lot to me, Adrian. It really does. It's, yeah, it stops me in my tracks, which people who know me well would tell you is extremely unusual. I am like Ronnie Corbett's love child. I can tell a story forever. That's really, I appreciate that. I had, there's a young man called Alex who does book reviews. He's down in Bristol, if he's listening. Great advocate of my work. And he picked up on a particular passage in 7 Degrees, I think, that he said stuck with him for weeks. Now, if the words that fall out of the keyboard onto paper do that to people, then my work is a long way from being done, but I feel I've achieved a great deal. If I can actually leave someone thinking about a scene, I do know, God bless her, there's a lovely lady down in Devon that was actually physically sick after reading a scene in Seven of Swords. I know, and I felt quite guilty about that. And she'll be listening. And the reality is, she said, but it was that powerful that it made me physically sick. Mm. And I felt terrible. I felt terrible. But she said, no, you mustn't apologize, because I was there. And I felt nauseous because I was there in the scene, not reading a book. And yes. I guess, you know, that word cinematographic is a lovely word, has been used a lot for my writing. And that again means a great deal to me, because I think I write cinematographically, if that makes sense.
You write with great vivid, you create incredible scenes that you that transport people. And if I think of one that really affected me in Angel, The Angel of Whitehall, it's quite early on, and not wishing to give too much away, but there are a number of people who have been transported from West Africa. They arrive on the River Medway, and there's a scene where some of them simply don't make it off the boat successfully and drown in the mud and the water as the tide comes in. It is so visceral and so gut-wrenching, and it really, really makes you angry that these things presumably, you know, have gone on. You think about the cockle pickers who were caught out in Morecambe Bay. Yes.
I remember it well, yeah.
Chinese immigrants who were put into a sort of a situation where they were forced to go out into the muds of Morecambe Bay, where the tide can come in just like that, and they were caught in it and drowned. It's very, very tough stuff. I mean, the fact is, Lewis, I mean, I think if I was to sum up how I feel about your books, it is, there are certain elements which are uniquely you. First of all, you're writing from experience, or people, you know, people who've gone through the things that you write about in a police procedural and, you know, that context. So it's entirely credible, even though some of the things that happen are huge. I mean, they're just monumental. It's Hollywood blockbuster stuff. in places. But nonetheless, they're based on, you know, how things would happen if those scenarios were created. So there's that. There's the emotional strength of your work, where you cannot help but empathise with the victims of things that are going on. And you have villains who you somehow can't help but like, even though they're terrible in terms of the things they do. There are so many elements. And there's this great sweep of, you know, that these are big books, both physically, but in scope and theme. They're just, I mean, it's there are so many elements which I love. And then you'll deliver a piece of dialogue which is so believable and on it that you're just, I'm not singing your praises here. And of course I am. I'm your publisher. I want people to buy your books and experience what I've experienced. And I recommend them all. But those are the things that that struck me when I first read Angel, particularly. And I can't wait to read The Chemist. But anyway, I've blown enough smoke up for the proverbial.
Yes, I have. I've just installed a chimney.
But those are the elements that you have, and you know, these are gifts in my book.
And since we talk about The Chemist, maybe we should ask, what can you tell us about The Chemist?
I've been keeping the title very secret because I wasn't sure if you were going to release it, but let's talk about The Chemist. The Chemist. Well, yes. So I had a tweet today from a lovely lady who's panicking. Hello, Carol. She's panicking that she needs to read The Angel very quickly in order to pick up the thread. Well, you don't need to, because The Angel is standalone. The Chemist. Now, this book, I think, is the fastest one I've written. I set out with this ludicrous idea, making it a lot smaller than the other books that I'm now looking at, that are putting huge burdens on my hardwood bookcase. But, you know, I can't do it, guys. I can't write a 250-page novella or a 300-page thriller, because the stories are just too damn big. And I guess an editor somewhere in the world would slash 20,000 words out of them, but
they may well still.
Yeah, they may well do, but I'm glad that they didn't, because I think, as Peter once said, you know, if the story's big enough, write it. And so The Chemist, I got some great feedback. And I'm trying to think if this is a spoiler or not. People haven't read the trilogy. So let's just say there's an individual character in the trilogy who is a particularly unpleasant person. He's not the lead antagonist in the trilogy. That's the Jackdaw, Alex Stefanescu, hideous husband and father to Nikolina Petrova and Elena Petrova. But one of his aides, if you like, lives to fight another day, and he comes back very much with some axes to grind in The Chemist. And the reason it's called The Chemist is because the individual has spent so long in prison in many countries around Northern Europe that he reads. Whilst he reads, he listens to Rachmaninoff, and he reads about being a surgeon and how to operate on people. So you'll know that scene from Seven of Swords, which I spent a lot of time with medical staff working on to make sure that it could be done. He likes to dabble in chemistry. He likes to mix potions, and he's got a fascination with toxins and poisons. And for this book, I turned to a man called Jeremy, who is British, lives in New Zealand, and is one of the foremost chemists, in my opinion, in the world. And he was so excited when I said to him, look, I want to make a character keen on chemistry. Well, it's as if I'd just given Jeremy the winning lottery ticket. So this individual and the chemist itself, there's a couple of agendas happening during the story. The individual wants to carry out some revenge against Detective Chief Inspector Jason Roberts, affectionately known by you now as Ginger, Ginger Roberts. And Ginger upset this individual, and they had it coming together in a tube train during one of the books of the trilogy. And this individual has had far too long sitting in prison since the end of the trilogy, and manages to leave Her Majesty's prison, Belmarsh, and heads out into the city to wreak havoc. But in order to start it off, he needs to wreak havoc with Mr. Roberts. He does it in the most appalling way. My mother has said to me she wants to disown me because she doesn't remember me having such a wicked imagination. And needless to say, it starts with a hell of a bang. And according to one very cherished pre-reader who always reads the books before anybody else, she has said that the magic dust is sprinkled again over the chemist. It's entirely different to The Angel, and it's very much different to the trilogy. But it's a story I don't think anybody's ever told. And it's basically about the elite of the City of London betting on people's lives.
Wow.
But in the sense of a casino. Hmm. So it's an unusual story. It's extremely dark in places. But as you know, what my books, I think, do fairly well from the feedback I get is that just when you've got that trademark writing style with the twists and the turns and the whodunits, you get slap-in-the-face humour. And the reason why I do that is because my brother actually said to me, you know, some of that humour and banter, it's not real. And I said, well, actually, in the job I do, it's very much like that. It's how you get through. It's how you actually survive. So, yeah, there is some humour. There's a particular scene which the pre-reader actually laughed out loud at and had to put the book down because she said it was so dark and so wonderfully written, but very funny at the same time. And you'll, I know probably in the next 10 days you'll get to read it. That's how confident I am.
We really look forward to it.
Well, you gave me a timeline. You both said, Lewis, can you get this damn thing done by X? And I said, I reckon I can. It needed to extend slightly because the ending was a bit bigger than I anticipated. And I really enjoyed that. And actually, the research on that, again, is so incredibly timely. Do you want a spoiler alert or not?
Go on.
Right now, there is something stuck up a canal. That's all I'll say to you, because I couldn't. It seemed to happen with, if you remember Seven of Swords, Brexit and the whole chaos around that, and you know this terrifying theory that if the British public were to find out what the Seventh Wave Syndicate knew, it would destroy the country. The timeliness with this one, with the good ship, container ship being stuck in the Suez Canal, is unreal.
Yes.
Absolutely unreal. You couldn't write it. So, yeah, the Chemist is a book I enjoy. Like, I enjoy writing them all, but this was good fun. It's set almost entirely in London. I've never worked there, but it's a city that just giving, isn't it?
We've taken enough of your time, Lewis, and I think it's perhaps time to wrap up. But I want to ask you one last question, if I may. Britain is awash with its with Line of Duty fever, and this is the series written by Jed Mercurio, which reached series 6, and it deals with anti-corruption in a mythical police force somewhere in Britain. From your perspective, and you know, it's truly addictive. It's larger than life in some ways, with the level of conspiracy that they're dealing with that's spread over these 6 series. But does it ring true as from your experience, or is it is it a really quite fantastical and not a reflection of how things might operate in those in that world?
Well, I've only seen two series because I'm struggling to get the third. I've just seen the second with the delightful Keely Hawes, who I think would make a cracking Carrie O'Shea. If Miss Hawes is listening, love you dearly. I would love you to play that role. Jeb Mercurio, you know, golden touch. You think of what he's been involved in over the years. I listened to Desert Island Discs. I think he was on the other day, and he talked about his humble beginnings. And I would adore the opportunity for someone like that to turn my trilogy into a series. Because, I mean, Line of Duty with Mr. Hate, Superintendent Hastings, which is ironic, is damn good television because it's clear they have a researcher. You see, I mean, most people of my era grew up with professional standards departments, whereas that's talking about anti-corruption, but it's kind of the same thing. Policing is a spectrum of society, isn't it? And it chooses from society. And the amount of corrupt police officers or those that are unprofessional, honestly, it is minuscule in comparison to the men and women that go out day and night to do an incredible job. I've been there running towards something when everybody else is running away. You don't give it a second thought, you just do it. And when you have corruption within policing, like when you see a Line of Duty, it sends a terrible cancerous sort of message right through the organization. I have no experience personally. I've been investigated. There are very few police officers that have gone up through the whole career and never been investigated, even though you know, of course, that you're innocent. If someone makes a complaint, you have to run it, and that's quite right. But Line of Duty is brilliant. It does push the envelope slightly at times, but show me a modern thriller series that doesn't. Bodyguard was another classic example. I think that was one of Jeb Mercurio's, wasn't it?
Absolutely, it was, yeah.
Yeah, and again, bang on, but with some wonderful detailed embellishment,
Yeah.
You have to, but yeah, Line of Duty. I mean, I love the fact that someone referred, as I say, I think you've used it as an advertising, as a marketing aim. A British reviewer wrote and said that you like Line of Duty, you'll love these books. And I think it's down to detail, realism, and complete authenticity. To say, if you've done something and you've walked into a building where you know someone's waiting for you. I remember searching an old mental hospital in Nottinghamshire with two colleagues once. We had two torches between us, and this was a Victorian building. I digress here, but bear with me. And 10 minutes into the search, the batteries went on the torches. We had to search this old Victorian mental hospital, almost just using your night vision, fingertips searching around old rooms that were still set up as a hospital. You can't write that. You can't make it up. So to be able to then have the gift to be able to put that into words and tell it as a story, I think you've been there. And it's clear that Line of Duty has some damn good researchers working with them.
It does indeed. And so do you. And you, life is one big piece of research. Lewis, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us from New Zealand. And for people who haven't experienced Jack Cade's story, there is the trilogy, the seventh trilogy, which we are obviously publishing, and also The Angel of Whitehall, which is a standalone, and The Chemist to come as well. So plenty to
enjoy.
And
many more after that.
Yeah, we hope.
But sadly for you two, I'm going to take you well over the edge at some point. I have enough stories to keep you occupied. fine. If you can keep putting up with me, I'll put up with you. How's that for a public public contract?
An interview so good, we ran two parts of it. Lewis Hastings joining us from New Zealand, and it's really an honour to be his publisher, and very, very kind words about us as people and as publishers and as friends, which...
I know, it's very touching, isn't
it? It is very touching. Let's hope it remains that way.
You're so cynical. Of course it will.
While we're here, we ought to remind or mention that this week we launched the Seventh Wave Trilogy as an ebook box set, which is available on Amazon for a knockdown rate. Well, not completely knocked down, but nonetheless, a good deal less unless you've bought them, if you bought them separately. But they are wonderful books. And don't forget, you can go to our website, www.hobeck.net, and order the paperbacks as well. We have, we can even get them signed for you with little plates in the front.
That's true, we can.
Wonderful books. And we'll hear from Lewis not too distant future when we get The Chemist ready for publication.
I think he's almost on the point of delivering The Chemist. So he sort of keeps dangling these carrots at us, doesn't he?
He does. So there was an image on Instagram where he said, that's it. It's a wrap.
I know, with a bottle of beer next to him. And I thought, OK, it's coming. But nothing quite yet.
But, you know, we're pretty strict as publishers. And so still got work to do, mate. That's all I'm saying.
If you're listening, Lewis, we know you probably are.
There'll be some editing to do for sure. Anyway, that was that. Now, let's get on with the really big news of the week, which is, of course, who is the winner of our fabulous Sleeping Dogs Wendy Turbin Easter competition for a bunch of cream eggs? And if people are wondering why there's a connection, it's because Penny Wiseman, who is the protagonist in those stories, the first of the series of Sleeping Dogs, loves cream eggs. So we thought we'd have a competition to celebrate the fact. And not only do you get cream eggs and a cream egg cookbook, but you also get Hobeck blend coffee made for us by the wonderful David over at, what's it called? Coffee Roasters.
Yes.
Oh, that's it. Courtyard Coffee Roasters. In Eccleshall,
in
Staffordshire.
And it tastes amazing. I mean, we also purchased some for ourselves because we love it so much.
Yeah. If you ever get the chance, you go through Eccleshall, go and find Courtyard Coffee Roasters, because David's shop is the most amazing tiny emporium full of coffee beans and coffee paraphernalia. Big tubs of in very rare coffee beans from all around the world, which he puts together in blends and roasts in a certain way. And he can spend a good deal of your day explaining how he does what he does. He's an absolute expert and passionate about it. So we fully recommend going to visit Courtyard Coffee Roasters if you're ever passing through. It'll become a tourist destination. I warn you.
I mean, it's like an Aladdin's cave, isn't it? Because you say, there's like... And the smell is amazing. Yeah.
Just go for the smell. That's wonderful. Anyway, let's get on with the announcement because we really are keeping people waiting.
So, the winner of the competition, which we drew today as we record, is Easter Sunday, so it finished at midday.
And this was drawn from all of our subscribers to the Hobeck website, www.hobeck.net. There will be another competition pretty soon, so keep your ears open for that. But nonetheless, that's where you can subscribe to the free books that we offer, which includes a Wendy Turbin short story, The Silence of the Rabbit. But the announcement is, I'm putting this off now.
You are.
I'll give you a drum roll, but I haven't got one.
No, we haven't got a drum, unfortunately. So we can just talk instead. So the winner is, and I should do, what's it called? Britain's Got Talent, when there's a massive pause, but I won't. The winner is...
My hats are falling off.
He's called Nick Brancacchio.
You've had time to rehearse this.
I don't know how you pronounce his name. I'm so sorry, Nick.
Brancaccio.
Oh, that's what I was trying to say.
Nick Brancaccio.
Yes.
Congratulations. That is wonderful.
And he was very pleased when he found out that he was a winner. So
what do you mean he's already found out?
Well, we had to contact him to get permission to say who he is online.
Oh, okay. Right. Well, that rather spoiled the big drum roll moment, isn't it? Well, Nick
Brancaccio. He's the only one who knows.
Yeah, congratulations for winning that. And thank you all of you who've subscribed. Don't forget to download your free books and also consider some of our other titles. And don't forget the code for the Hobcast. Hobcast20 will give you 20% off any of the paperbacks that we offer. And indeed our mugs.
Absolutely. And as you indicated, there will be another competition. So, you know, all is not lost. You might win the next one. And it's going to be a good one.
It's going to be tied to the forthcoming Merseyside crime series. We can't say any more than that at the moment, by Malcolm Hollingdrake, which is due out in just a couple of weeks' time.
I know.
So we're going to tie that together, and we're really looking forward to publishing that too. Have we got any other news? It's just been a really busy week.
Yes, it has been a busy week. I mean, my own personal news is that I finally got the jab. So I am now a vax hole as well. And I did feel like that. So I went to get the jab. And I went to the county showgrounds in Stafford here. So a massive venue. And it really did feel like a sheep dip because there were so many people there at the same time. Or like the airport when you sort of filtered into different lines to go through the various bits and bobs of the stages of the questions and the here's your form and sign your form and blah, blah, blah. And I went shopping afterwards, and I must admit, I had that feeling of invincibility, even though it's not real and you know it's not real, so you still wear the mask and you still abide by social distancing. But it did give me that sort of slight confidence just because I'd got the stuff in my system. It was very odd.
It is an odd feeling, but yeah, you've still got to wait 3 weeks for it to take some sort of effect.
Yeah, and I was really nervous about side effects as well, because you hear all sorts. Some people say they had no side effects. You didn't really have very many, did you?
No, I just made the most of it.
But the day... made the most of it. Yes, he milked it for all he could get.
Yeah, I had man flu for it. Oh, that was awful.
Well, you slept a lot, I noticed.
Yeah, I did. I was it did knock me out a little bit. But no major problems.
No, so for me, I was okay on the day, and then the following day I was a little bit tired. But when it came to about 9 o'clock that night, I suddenly came down really, really cold and shivery, and I couldn't warm myself up. It was very odd. I don't think I've ever felt like that. So it felt like I imagined flu would feel. I've never had flu, so I don't know. But I was fine the next day. But that, I would guess, was a side effect of...
Yeah, I mean, it was your body, you know, working up its antibodies, I assume.
So I couldn't work for a few hours. It was really hard.
Which meant Hobeck did nothing because, you know, I can't stress enough, this tooth pain is like unlike anything I've ever experienced in my life. And I think it just goes to show, I mean, I haven't been able to get to my dentist all the way through pandemic. Just what can happen if things are allowed to slide. Anyway, that's my excuse. Let's hope that when we join you next week for our next Hobcast, I'll be in better fettle. But we have a lovely programme next week. We are speaking to three of the blogging community, the people who write reviews for the passion for books and do a great deal to get the word out there about the books that we produce and many other small and independent authors put out there as well. So we're really grateful to them, and we will be speaking to a trio of book bloggers next week. Can't wait for that. That's going to be extremely instructive, and we've got some great guests lined up. In fact, they're queuing up. They're actually asking to get on the program, which is just lovely.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think we've got guests into the whole of April and then some of May as well. It's fantastic.
I'm sure it'll dry up eventually, but at the moment things are going well, and we're extremely grateful to you for listening. For all of you who feedback on the books and buy the books and read the books and support Hobeck in so many ways, you know, we really are buoyed by that. And to think that, you know, we're not even at a year of publishing actual books, it's quite extraordinary how things have grown. But we'll reflect on that when we get to, I suppose, episode 25. Probably be a good opportunity to do that. That'll be probably in July, I would imagine. My maths is terrible. But this has been Hobcast number 12. I'm Agent Hobart.
I'm Rebecca Collins, the one who doesn't have tooth pain.
Indeed. And it's been a real pleasure to be with you again this week. So we've heard from Lewis Hastings. Don't forget, check out our website, www.hobeck.net. But for now, have a wonderful and creative week.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.